listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Communism died this year. America won the Cold War.
That was then-President George H.W. Bush giving his State of the Union address in January of 1992, his last, as it would turn out, a month after the collapse of the Soviet Union. That optimistic view of things 26 years ago has been supplanted by a new perspective that prevails in Washington. This is the Deputy Secretary of State and Permanent Representative to NATO from the United States, K. Bailey Hutchison, speaking at NATO this past Tuesday. She had accused Russia of violating the INF, or Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, treaty.
The United States does not want to withdraw from the treaty. We certainly don't intend to violate the treaty. But if Russia continues to say they are not violating when the evidence is clear that they are, then diplomacy needs to be strengthened, and we need to look for other ways to bring Russia to the table.
Ma'am, can you be more specific in what kind of new information that you are bringing to the table regarding the breach of the INF treaty, and more specifically also what kind of countermeasures that you are considering? Thank you.
Well, the countermeasures would be to take out the missiles that are in development by Russia in violation of the treaty.
Well, you said to take out the missiles that are in development. We all got a bit excited here. Do you mean to get those withdrawn? You don't mean to actually take them out in a more kinetic sense?
Well, withdrawing, yes. Getting them to withdraw would be our choice, of course. But I think the question was, what would you do if this continues to a point where we know that they are capable of delivering And at that point, we would then be looking at the capability to take out a missile that could hit any of our countries in Europe and hit America.
What was it exactly that the U.S. was hoping for after spending 80 years to smother the Soviet infant in its cradle, as Winston Churchill put it at the time of the Russian Revolution? We discussed that today with Professor Luciana Bone, who spoke with us via telephone Wednesday.
The question that we need to address is, what kind of Russia did Washington want? And also, how did Russia fail to fulfill Washington's great expectations of the 1990s? How did Russia go from triumphant McDonaldization to state sponsor of terror in Washington in 30 years in wow. Washington's eyes.
Yeah.
So we see that 30 years ago there were these great expectations indeed.
Yeah, let me just say on that point, by the way, I mean, it's an interesting question to raise, because this is the culmination of a project that began about 8 minutes after the October Revolution, the moment the communists took power, essentially, when Lenin and the Bolsheviks took state power. That moment, the U.S., the U.K., you know, the capitalist construct around the world targeted Russia, then the Soviet Union. They, you know, Churchill famously smothered that Bolshevik thing in its cradle, and they spent gazillions of dollars and went through a whole other war, kind of dancing around the question, and a Cold War, nuclear weapons rattling at each other, all kinds of stuff. Gazillions of dollars spent to accomplish what they accomplished in December of 1991. So they paid top dollar in history for this. Now let's find out, what did they think they bought?
Yeah. Well, what they thought they bought was a colony, essentially. So I'm thinking that this last triumph, or rather the triumph, as they see it, of 1991, they didn't make the best use of it. You didn't have a George Kennan at the helm, the American advisor who was the author of the containment policy in 1946, of the containment of communism. You didn't have guys in policy positions who were like George Kennan, who, for example, in the case of Western Europe after World War II, built up Western Europe as an industrial power to make it a partner, sort of sub-partner of the U.S. Instead, what these neoliberal guys 70 years later did was loot it first. I think this was a tremendous mistake and a symptom of the ideological decay of the United States, of United States capitalist ideology.
Yep.
It's just a thought that came to me when you asked the question, what did they do wrong this time? How did they jump the gun? What did they want from Russia? They wanted from Russia not even Britain, France, Germany of the post-war. What they wanted was Poland.
Right.
Do you see what I'm...
Yeah, I mean, look, like Keenan had the benefit of of being able to live inside of a contained universe for his worldview. The task at the moment after World War II looking at the socialist bloc emerging wasn't necessarily what is the future of our system going to be, but rather we have to block this emerging system from supplanting our future, or supplanting us as the dominant power in the future. And so you have like a framework to operate in that's not finally dispositive, but rather it's reactive, and the goal is a more immediate goal, which is to, you know, take down the adversary, take down the competitor. Once you've accomplished that, you have to ask more existential questions. Well, what exactly am I now that I dominate the world? What are my goals? What's my modus operandi going to be? What's the purpose? Those questions come, they're finally forced on you in 1991, for example, and no one is prepared to answer them. Instead, as Marx predicted 150 years before, and Lenin predicted, you know, 80 years before, and everybody saw that was looking at it critically, it goes on automatic pilot. We need to increase and intensify our extraction of value, and so consequently, at this stage of our development, all we want to do is loot. We want to take your stuff.
Yeah. And that means, of course, instant profits, instant loot. What would an intelligent George Kennan, have suggested? Look, one of the emerging economic powers in the world, and this was noted even in the 1990s, is China. How about we turn Russia into a comfortable Western Germany,
right,
and build bases there like we right. have, you know.
Make Russia the Western.
Federation for containing China, for example.
Make Russia into the Western Europe of 1950s.
Exactly.
Okay.
But no, they couldn't wait for that. Nope. There was no preparation for that. In fact, this is what I wanted to get to. Those crazies in the, what is it called, the plan for the new American century?
Yeah, PNAC. Yeah, right, PNAC.
Yeah, PNAC. Oh, you know, they were just so high on testosterone of victory that they launched they wrote what Pilger said, the charter of terrorism, that is, that they were terrorist charters. Oh, let's go for 7 wars in 7 Middle Eastern things, let's loot Russia, everything at once. So, really, when you opened with your very excellent question, I mean, it sort of put me off the track from the outline I made, but it was an important question. And it actually opened my eyes, the question, but I was thinking about it even before, that what a monumental mistake, how they missed an opportunity, speaking from their point of view, to turn what happened in Russia into an advantage. I mean, they humiliated Russia, they called it a defeat, they refused to treat it as even an equal partner the way Britain was in to a certain, not exactly equal, but at least, you know, with some respect and some dignity. And now they're complaining that Russia didn't become Poland, which I keep repeating. So how did this now? Just to trace the degradation of relationships that started from there, actually, between Russia and the Soviet Union. I mean, 30 years ago, they had these great expectations. And so, for example, you can tell from a New York Times editorial in, I think it was 1989, it celebrated the opening of a McDonald's restaurant in Moscow.
And it Square said, here.
Yeah, you have it. The prospect of golden arches on Gorky Street moved a step closer today when the McDonald's Corporation agreed to help put two all beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, and onions on a Soviet bun. The Big Mac will be sold in its original form at 20 McDonald's restaurants in Moscow and will be known as the Bolshoi Mac. Bolshoi means big in Russian, they say.
Yes.
So the Golden Arches near Red Square would not be the first in a communist country. A McDonald's opened in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, earlier this year. Another is expected to open in Budapest this month. So, you know, there is a tremendous arrogance in that statement, Soviet bun. And so, among other things, Russia was expected to be a dumping ground for American goods and services. That you know, already, this is what they're celebrating. But what happened between that celebration and 2018, we have now a bill pending, which is called Defending America's Security from Kremlin Aggression Act of 2018. Kremlin Aggression Act. It was introduced in the U.S. Senate by a group of five Republican and Democratic senators on August 2, 2018. And, of course, among them was the recently departed virulent Russophobe, Senator John McCain. So the pending bill calls for sanctions on Russian banking, currency trade, investing in Russia's sovereign debt, as well as on oligarchs and parastatal entities and cyber actors in Russia. It calls on Congress to assess whether Russia meets the criteria for designation as a state sponsor of terrorism.
Right.
So, and it says that the U.S. will, quote, not waver in our rejection of Russian President Vladimir Putin's effort to erode Western democracy as a strategic imperative for Russia's future.
Yeah.
What actually happened?
It's even getting crazier than that, because we saw, what was her name, Kay Hutchison, whatever her name was, used to be governor of Texas, who's now the State Department, deputy something or other, saying yesterday or the day before, publicly, at NATO or someplace else, like some big public forum, that we accused Russia of violating the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. When we find them, we're going to go in and blow that stuff up. In other words, you've got missiles that violate our treaty, and we're coming in to take them out. That's what she said yesterday or the day before. That's how crazy it's getting now. So
it's what's crazy. And not to mention that who reneged on the who killed the anti-ballistic missile treaty, which guaranteed mutually assured destruction and thus strategic stability. That was G.W. Bush. The Obama administration launched a $1 trillion program to ramp up U.S. nuclear capabilities and ballistic missile defense with the aim of achieving superiority in a nuclear conflict. I mean, starting in the year 2000, something horrible happened, and Russia became the Soviet Union again. And the whole Cold War had to be fought all over again. So, you know, how did Russia fail to meet Washington's great expectation? Well, Washington's idea was to transform post-communist Russia into some facsimile of the American capitalist system, but not on terms of equality, of course, but on terms of subordination, and not even subordination of the kind that Western Europe has.
Right.
In fact, below the subordination of allies of Western Europe order of hierarchy.
And that's something. The existence of this hierarchy, by the way, is something that I don't think people give enough weight to, because, you know, let's remember, the U.S. military still occupies Germany, okay?
And
Japan, and much of Europe, and much of Asia.
That's right.
You know, the U.S. military in South Korea, for example, is basically the Japanese occupation of the southern part of Korea, and simply the United States subsequently occupying Japan and taking over the bases that the Japanese were occupying Korea with. This is where we are at. And in the case of Korea, there hasn't been a change in legal status at all. There's been no peace treaty, no nothing. In Europe, it's more subtle, but, you know, the peace treaties still stand. There was some, you know, fulfillment of it in 1989 with the, you know, reunification of Germany and such, but a lot of those terms still stand. Again, the U.S. military is still physically occupying Europe, and it's of right. It's of right. And if you actually watch the way European governments operate in connection with the U.S. in terms of foreign policy, for example, towards Russia, for example, towards Korea, for example, towards just about any place else, including Cuba, Venezuela, etc., then you can see that there is still a hierarchy, and they are below the United States in, you know, in terms of the food chain. They are food and not diner.
That's right. The hierarchy is really otherwise called as the empire.
Yep.
And so, and as you pointed out, there is a subservience in Western Europe, for example, to American policies toward anybody, you know, anybody that the United States indicates as a problem.
Angela Merkel does not tap President Obama's phone. Okay.
Sorry, what did you say?
Angela Merkel does not tap President Obama's phone. That only goes one way.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's right. Now, what we have just now is the European Union's position on Iran.
Yes.
Which promises to break, in appearance, the pattern of subservience to Washington's policies.
In appearance.
The European Union said they will build a financial mechanism to deal with Iran, bypassing the reinstated sanctions that Washington applied to Iran. Now, okay. That sounds very good.
Yes.
But what happens when, let's say, the French Total and the big companies in Europe say, okay, you know, it's very well you promised to protect us. But what if we can't, what if the U.S. shuts us out of their market? Yeah. What are you going to do then?
There's another aspect to it, too. And this is the real tell. I mean, they raise that question. Yeah. It's a mischievous one. What, you know, this is not happening in isolation. The deep state, quote unquote, the real power in the West, cut that deal with Iran. They want it. This guy in the White House is an aberration, and this is some kind of fetish he has about this particular policy. In their eyes, that's the way they see it. And forget whatever his or their, you know, intentions actually are in his administration.
Sure.
And so the thing is that as Europe rebels, quote-unquote, against the United States, it happens to align with the media, the intel agencies, a good part of the Congress, the institutional power in Washington and in London, and et cetera, in general. In other words, this rebellion, they're, you know, joining with the king to rebel. It's a rebellion against Trump.
They're
it's just part and parcel of it.
With the
king.
Ahead.
Trump isn't the king. Trump is the figurehead. The actual king wants the deal with Iran that was struck with Iran, which isn't as portrayed, by the way, as you know.
Right.
But they want that deal, and Trump is thwarting it, and so they want to thwart Trump. And so they tell the people who have the real power in Washington, not the White House, the people who have the real power in Washington, tell Europe, go ahead and make the deals you want to with Iran as if Trump weren't there.
Yeah.
That's what's operating.
Yeah.
So it's not a rebellion. That's my point. It's not really a rebellion.
Yeah, I can see that. Because, of course, the point I made, that the corporations, the big interests in Europe, will also rebel.
Right. And the problem is,
no,
and who's going to cover for them?
We don't want to make an enemy of the United States. And, you know, the European Union tried the same gambit with Cuba. And they came to, some years ago, I don't remember when, and they came to a consensus. In other words, they dropped the challenge.
Right after Helms-Burton. I remember when the United States said, not only do we want you to stop trading, we want everybody you trade with to stop trading, we want you to not trade with anybody that trades with Cuba. And they said, no, that's ridiculous, you don't have jurisdiction over us. And there was a push and shove, and then they said, oops, sorry, you're right, never mind. And that's basically what happened.
Yeah. It's just tremendously cynical.
Yep.
And yes, you point out that the subservience, that there is the deep state, and this is that the European Union is actually, in the guise of rebellion, doing what the powers that are behind the White House.
Right, the real power.
And challenging the White House, actually.
Right.
Want. So, right. This...
let's bring it back to our point. So what we're doing is we're trying to divine what is it exactly that the West expected out of Russia, what kind did Washington want, and I guess we'll have to say really, because we kind of peeled off a few layers, what kind of Russia did the power elite in the West want? The one that directed the 80 or whatever years worth of policy to stop the spread of communism and socialism around the world and to take down that nasty nest of it, you know, took hold in 1917. What did they want besides just to survive to do after that? And that's where we are, right?
Where we are at now, 2018, and why the Kremlin is seen as the evil empire again.
Right, that's right.
The fact of the matter is that, unlike Western European countries, Russia is now not led by yapping poodles.
Right.
The Russian government and its people have not rolled over. They have historically never done so.
Right.
So the idea that this country with immense history and, as I mentioned before, sacrifices and just this tragic history, they expected it to disappear from the face of the earth. So Washington was completely deluded when he thought they would do so. So let me quote from a paper that was composed in 1993, and a famous paper. It was the Pentagon's Defense Planning Guidance for the fiscal year 1994-1999, the one that said that the United States would prevent the rise of another economic and political rival as the Soviet Union had been. So composed in 1993, it thought it improbable that Russia would regain a leadership that would act in the Russian national interest. This is what they said. It is improbable. This is 1993, and they expected Russia never to rise again. It is improbable that a global conventional challenge to U.S. and Western security will reemerge from the Eurasian heartland for many years to come. In fact, it came in 7 years later. Even in the highly unlikely event that some future leadership in the former Soviet Union adopted strategic aims of recovering the lost empire or otherwise threatened global interest, the loss of the Warsaw Pact allies and the subsequent and continuing dissolution of military capability would make any hope of success require several years or more of strategic and doctrinal reorientation and force regeneration and redeployment, which in turn could only happen after a lengthy political realignment and reorientation to authoritarianism.
And go ahead, finish that because I want to pause.
No, go ahead, comment.
So
that's
what they expected in 1993. So this is A. Wes Mitchell, Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee August 21st of this year. Here's what he says. Contrary to the hopeful assumptions of previous administrations, you just read us one of those hopeful assumptions, one of the first ones out of the gate, Russia and China, by the way, are serious competitors that are building up the material and ideological wherewithal to contest U.S. primacy and leadership in the 21st century. It continues to be among the foremost national security interests of the United States to prevent the domination of the Eurasian landmass by hostile powers. They mean by the people that live on it, I guess. The central aim of the administration's foreign policy is to prepare our nation to confront this challenge by systematically strengthening the military, economic, and political fundaments of American power. So they're saying, well, actually, they are a threat, and it's actually Russia and China now. So I don't know. If you chip off the Warsaw Pact countries and then add China and the massive factory that China has become, I wonder how that balances.
Yes. No, total myopic vision. And it's a symptom of the decline of power and power and political intelligence of the ruling class. Right. I mean, they went for loot first.
Well, we're out of time now, so we're going to have to stop there and pick it up next week at this point. But Luciana, thank you very much. I'm definitely enjoying this conversation.
My pleasure, Don. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
I'm Afshin Ratansi, and you're watching a special edition of Going Underground as NATO defense ministers meet in the Polish capital, Warsaw, ahead of one of NATO's largest ever military exercises. I'm with legendary journalist and filmmaker John Pilger. John, thanks for coming back on.
You're welcome.
Let's go straight to your latest piece. You quote the late Robert Parry of Consortium News, claiming that there are approved opinions and brushed aside unapproved evidence. Just go through that.
Yes, well, I think you can categorize the news as approved or unapproved. Basically, we're allowed to see the approved news, but not allowed to see the unapproved news. It's usually the unapproved version is the evidence. It doesn't have to be proof, but it is the evidence. It's the piece in the puzzle that allows us to make sense of the news. We're denied that.
Okay, but then it makes it a bit more complicated when it comes to Iran, because Britain is now, after many years of opposing Iran, on the same side as Iran and Russia and China against the United States on the Iran nuclear deal. What do you make of Trump appearing to threaten Iran again and again and Britain being on the same side as Russia and Iran? That must really hurt in a mainstream media newsroom.
It's such a complicated place, the world. It really is. Sometimes the pieces go to the wrong end of the board when it's convenient, and sometimes the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and therefore the most wicked alliances have to be forged, and twas ever thus. So, yes, if Britain doesn't want, and most of the EU don't want Trump to go ahead and sanction Iran and haul down the Iranian government, because there are riches to be made in Iran. There is great trade to be done in Iran. There is oil to be bought in Iran. There is a great deal of advantage to be gained. in the time-honored rail politic way of dealing with Iran. Truth be told, they never liked, that is, the UK and the EU, never liked the US obsession with Iran. The US obsession with Iran goes back to the fall of the Shah of Persia, who was one of the main pillars of US so-called foreign policy in the Middle East. And when that came down in 1979, the US has never really recovered its sense, its equilibrium, if you like, its power in the Middle East. It wants Iran back. If not back, it wants to deny Iran the independence of the Iranian state. Now, why Trump in particular is obsessed with this, I don't know. But why shouldn't he be? He's an American president. He's doing what American presidents always do. The fact that he's Trump then causes apoplexy in the media and the intelligence agencies and so on, for the very good reason that he's exposed America without a mask. America and the presidency without a mask is Trump. He's a caricature, and he does what he wants to do. But be assured that a president, Hillary Clinton, would probably be doing the same thing to Iran. This is the same Hillary Clinton that when she first went campaigning in 2009 said at one rally that she was prepared to annihilate Iran. I think there are 60 million plus people in Iran. She was prepared to annihilate them. So it's basically what the American establishment wants to do, but they don't want to be seen to be doing what Trump wants to do. There's a internecine warfare going on within the United States between Trump and those who really are the institutional foundation of American power.
Clinton, certainly, Hillary Clinton said that they would bomb Syria. But the National Security Advisor, before he was detained on this program, said Syria, there would be a difference in policy under Trump. They seem to be pro-Russian. But now they're saying the United States will be in Syria forever to attack Iranian facilities in Syria. Just take us through where we are at Syria. I mean, we don't hear anything about Syria in Britain suddenly.
It's very difficult to tell. I couldn't in any way chart American thinking. It comes back online from time to time, and it's American so-called policy on Syria is pretty much the same as UK policy. They're saying pretty much what they're saying now. We've got to get rid of the Assad, who was then Bashar Assad's father. We've got to get rid of this. We've got to control Syria. They're obsessed with Syria to the point where in recent years they haven't really bothered whether they put in power in Damascus, perhaps one of the most medievalist and vicious regimes one could imagine, that led by ISIS. My own reading is that Trump would like to get out of Syria. It's messy. It's costly for him. He doesn't really need it. There's no morality here. He just pragmatically doesn't want it. But there is Russia in Syria, quite successfully in Syria, if you like, having helped to stave off a major defeat of the government. So he feels he must face up to them.
Well, Venezuela in the Western Hemisphere is in British media every other day. I mean, it's odd because it seems so far away. Why suddenly is Venezuela a big issue? The approved evidence would suggest Maduro is some kind of dictator. What do you make of what's going to happen in Venezuela? I should add that seven countries, Argentina, Colombia, Chile, Peru, Paraguay, I think that's seven, say that Maduro should go to the International Criminal Court. That's just after he's been recently seen with the Chinese authorities.
Well, that's going back to the old days, as the United States used to have the entire Latin American continent, its so-called leaders, as its stooges, basically, who would say what the United States wanted them to say. When you mentioned, if we go back to the unapproved news, that is news we don't hear about, there's been an attempted coup in Nicaragua, a coup by the United States, very, very similar to the one it carried out in Honduras nearby, very similar to the one it wants to carry out in Venezuela. But it's failed in Nicaragua. Now, that failure is unapproved. Therefore, we don't really hear about it. We hear obsessively. Venezuela is the kind of Syria, in news terms, of the Latin American continent. I mean, going back, which I think a little bit of the background is necessary, when you... I read just before I came in here a study by the University of the West of England into BBC reporting of the major Chavez years, that is 1998 to 2008. It took 304 news reports on the BBC about Venezuela. Three out of 304 mentioned anything positive about a government that had more than halved the poverty in that country and had set up a whole infrastructure of welfare and education for the first time in Venezuela. Chavez was the most elected man in the world, I have to say. He held a world record for going before the people to be elected. Maduro must closely follow, but his country is in difficulty. And one of the reasons, major reasons it's in difficulty, the major reason in my view, is that the total collapse of oil and also the collapse of any real will inside Venezuela to perhaps deal with it. But when I say that, I want to mitigate that with the massive war of so-called sanctions, that rather benign word that's used, of a blockade on Venezuela. President Obama, you may remember, called Venezuela a threat to the national security of the United States. And he began, really, that whole blockade that Trump is now enforcing on Venezuela. The fact that Venezuela has held out, the government has held out, I suppose that in many ways the society has held out, although it's suffered a great deal for as long as it has, is extraordinary.
So do you think the effect of sanctions, you call it a weapon of war, is not as effective nowadays? Of course, the USA is sanctioning Russia, sanctioning China, in a way, the tariffs. Do you think the days when it could sanction a country's governance out of existence are over?
Depends how powerful that country is. Russia is massively sanctioned, but Russia goes on. It goes on and it's formed a very close alliance with China. China is a bit sanctioned, might be more sanctioned. It doesn't really give a damn, actually. But we don't have a sense of this great hinterland of alternative power, Russia and China, of this, if you like, the Eurasian power. We don't get a sense. We're so Atlantic-centric, if you like, that we think only of Europe, the United States, the so-called West all the time. But there is an enormous part of the world that, yes, it's sanctioned, but it's getting on, and it's getting on in many areas, particularly forging alliances with other countries very, very successfully.
In this latest article of yours, you exhort readers and viewers to translate a kind of newspeak. The slashing of public expenditure you translate into what we hear is efficiency savings. The destruction of civilized life, you say, is really the translation of hard choices.
It's a complete invention. 10 years ago, we're now mourning the anniversary of the Great Crash. If you remember the way the Great Crash in Wall Street and in the City of London elsewhere was reported, it was reported as the crooked banks. It was quite astonishing. Right across the British press, you would see
it's their fault.
Pictures of the banks and of... We name the guilty bankers, and people will be hauled out, and they'd be shamed in public, as usually lesser beings are shamed in the public.
Trade unions, usually, and
others. But so that lasted, I calculated, for just under a year, about 9 months. And then it changed. It wasn't the debt, the crooked banks. Alistair Darling, Gordon Brown's chancellor, forked out £500 billion, effectively gave it to the banks. I'm sorry if I'm a few billion out there, but it was an epic amount of the country's treasure.
It was a hard choice.
And gave it hard choice. And that was good. The approved news was that was good. But the crooked banks and the crooked bankers then disappeared from the media. Instead, a word that was just lying in the dictionary, being used from time to time during the Second World War, austerity, was hauled out, and we now have something called austerity. And austerity means that all the civilized premises of life in this country have to be attacked, have to be undermined. The hospitals have to be starved of funds. The poor people have to remain poor people and indeed get poorer. Everything has to be cut back. Councils have to lose something like up to 40% of the money they have available to do normal things for people in it, that is their responsibility. That went overnight. The debt became our debt. It became people's debt. The whole notion of crooked banks went completely. I've never known a reversal of from fact to illusion so completely. And it was accepted. It was accepted by all sides. It was accepted by both sides in Parliament. It was accepted by all media. It would be, yes, but even those that had named the guilty bankers with such enthusiasm no longer named them. Austerity had to be solved. The debt had to be paid back above all. It was a complete con. It was an ideological situation. The National Health Service could have been paid several times over by the money that fled this country, hemorrhaged from this country, allowed by the tax regime.
John, I'll stop you there. More from John Pilger after the break.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back. I'm still with award-winning journalist and filmmaker John Pilger. John, you say the 2012 Health and Social Care Act, so what, 4 years after the crash of Lehman Brothers, ended legally universal free health care in Britain?
Yes, it did. Before 2012, the Secretary of State had a responsibility. When Beveridge wrote the original charter and Aneurin Bevan brought it to law in 1948, it was very simple and very clear. It was based on a great cooperative thing that collectively the state and the society had responsibility for all our health, and the responsibility, the ultimate responsibility, rested with the Secretary of State for Health to see that all that happened. The 2012 Health and Social Care Act took that away and created an enormous quango called NHS England. And the fragmentation of the NHS began. I have to say, in many respects, it's rather a brilliant, subtle operation because it's got a kind of deniability built into it. No, we're not privatising. We're just fragmenting it and we'll give it to others quietly. That was done on the back of this invention, austerity. Now, I think all that is worth understanding. I think it's worth understanding in its own terms, but worth understanding in terms of our theme of approved and unapproved news. The BBC's reporting of the 2012 Health and Social Welfare Act was really a disgrace.
You quote the headline.
It was
BBC
a disgrace.
Bill which gives power to GPs.
Yeah.
Classes.
Well, which is a complete distortion of, but they summed up this bill that really abolished Aneurin Bevan's whole notion of a national health service, and which most of the people of this country, I would suggest, still believe is the notion of a national health service.
Okay, if that's the BBC headline about that, yeah. You also quote something, if anyone thinks Britain isn't in the lead in some things, you said a survey cites that the BBC was bottom of NATO nation broadcasters in offering opposition airtime in the run-up to the Iraq War. This is, let alone Libya, Syria.
2003, where... that's correct. That was a media tenor.
That's worse than any other NATO
survey.
Nation.
It was below. I was vaguely surprised to see, though not really, I suppose, the BBC just below the American networks, the likes of CNN, in offering so little facility to those who opposed the invasion of Iraq, and I have to say who represented the majority of this country, who also opposed it. Another follow-up academic study by the University of Wales at Cardiff found pretty much the same thing. It said that basically what the BBC reported was what the government wanted it to report. It didn't really challenge, it amplified what the government was saying, and we know that the government was lying through its teeth.
The anti-Corbyn paper, if I put it that way, The Guardian, you don't seem to like that paper too much. I mean, when editor Kath Viner says it's a progressive, a thoughtful and progressive newspaper, and you say, particularly when it comes to Julian Assange, of course, who's in the...
Well, it's so thoughtful and progressive, and... in the way it's conducted a campaign of unrelenting vindictiveness against Julian Assange.
Why do you think The Guardian hates Julian Assange?
It's sometimes it strikes me as a kind of an unrequited love or something. Assange, they fell in love with and they got a lot from him. They exploited him. They won all sorts of awards. They got Hollywood movie deals. They got a book. They ended up getting a fabled Pulitzer. It was basically on the back of what Assange and WikiLeaks, in its brief tenure with The Guardian, had given them. But once that affair was over, Assange received the full force of The Guardian's displeasure. And I think in that article, I quote a number of its leading columnists in the kind of abuse that I don't think I've seen in a serious newspaper, I can't remember I've seen actually, against an individual. Assange refused to be a member of the club. He shamed so many journalists because he had more firsts, if you like, in scoops in what WikiLeaks revealed than they've had in their whole in lifetimes. He was so successful, and he showed, I think, that the media is really, has probably always has been, never more so than now, an appendage of established power. He shone a light on that, and that was unforgivable.
And yet it was just one small organization, WikiLeaks, because I know you also quote the disgraced CIA boss, former CIA boss Petraeus, saying a war of perception conducted continuously using the news media is what is being called for. Isn't that just something they say to their people?
No. Well, certainly it'll come out of all their dreadful corporate jargon cluttered conferences that they go to, the head of the British Armed Forces, Chief of the General Staff, I think January this year, Sir Nick Carter, said pretty much the same thing. He said that, you know, what appeared in the media was much more important than defeating the enemy. Now, what they're saying on both sides of the Atlantic is that they're identifying the true enemy. In a war of basic propaganda, a lot of people are killed in this war of propaganda, but it is a war of propaganda. The main enemy are the people at home. The main enemy for General Petraeus were the American people. The main enemy for Sir Nick Carter are the British people. They'll end up with unapproved opinions, and that could be calamitous for a world without militarism, without nuclear weapons, all the things that they don't want, and they feel very insecure about, clearly.
Well, we began by talking about those military exercises, and I know in your latest article you end with none other figure than Leni Riefenstahl, the propagandist for the Nazis in the end. This channel, obviously, RT, R standing for Russia, which you mentioned in the context of World War II, has been targeted.
Yes.
And the Prime Minister in Parliament said that people
yes.
should not appear on it. What do you make of the attack on this?
Yes. Well, it's the beating heart of the propaganda, isn't it? My experience with RT is that it produces news and views that, by and large, you don't find in other places. My only criticism of RT is when I think it perhaps tries to be a little bit too respectable from time to time, perhaps like the BBC.
Not on this.
But that never happens to you, thanks, Afshin, so that's encouraging. So it's a difference. It provides a different perspective. And it also has rather high standards, in my view. I think its journalists are professional. Its news, its people, its some of its journalists are very brave, actually.
We've lost some journalists in the past year. We've lost some journalists.
Yes. So all this is something of a threat. Most of the attacks, like the attacks on Julian Assange, have come from the other media, haven't they? When it's the Kremlin-controlled RT. It's so absurd and so wrong. I think it's very good news that RT has weathered all this. At least I hope it has.
Jeremy Corbyn's Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell said on the state mandate of BBC that he won't appear on this show, say. He's been on this show before. And other of Corbyn's MPs shouldn't appear on this channel.
Actually, he was invited, I think, to say that by Andrew Marr, on the very establishment Bellwether programme, the Andrew Marr show. And he, I think from memory, he agreed, well, I know this shouldn't happen anymore. That's extraordinary, isn't it? Coming from a journalist, it ran a bus straight through any notion of free speech and brought the establishment view of the kind of discussion we're having as something that's controlled by invisible puppet masters in the Kremlin. It's so ridiculous, so absurd, and so unbecoming of Jeremy Corbyn's number two. But you know, the problem with parliamentary politics, one of the problems, is there's, because we have a media that has sort of put out a contract for Jeremy Corbyn and attacks him unrelentingly, there is no real critical discussion from the other side. I hate to say it, but even from the left, there is no real critical discussion outside a program like this. There's nothing on the BBC. There's nothing really on any of the other mainstream programs. So McDonald can ingratiate himself, as he was doing, clearly, with Marr and the BBC by saying that and not be challenged. That's a pity.
John Pilcher, thank you.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.